Okay, hopefully you've all got your notes now. Let's take a quick look at the first section in today's passage. It starts in verse 17 like this, and it's pretty hard-hitting stuff. It says this: "Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, due to the hardness of heart. They have become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity." Heavy stuff. This is actually one of five sections in chapters 4 and 5 where Paul marks it out by using the word walk. He's saying, walk this way in your Christian life, or walk away from that in your Christian life. Last week was actually the first of these five sections, where Paul says, walk in a manner worthy of your calling. And he looks at apostles and prophets and teachers and all the rest of it, you remember from last week. This week, in this section, it's on the crucial subject of how we live out, how we walk out change in our lives. How we walk away from sin, which is disobedience to God, and get closer to Jesus. That's what this is all about. So this morning is there for us where we need to change. It might be, though, I'm aware and touching on this subject, that we've got some slight realism issues related to the subject of change. We might be a little bit deluded and think, well, basically I'm okay. Basically I don't need to change too much. So I thought perhaps we should help each other a little bit with this. So why don't you turn to the person next to you and say to them, look, you really need to change. I think you better pay attention to this. Turn to the person next to you and say, look, you really need to change. Yeah, that's right. You tell them. Some of you seem to have quite a bit to say to the other person on this subject. We've established that we all need to change. And now that I've got an atmosphere of vulnerability and openness established in the room, I think we can move on. We're working with the assumption that we've all got mess in our lives. We've all got junk in our lives. Some of us are better at hiding it than others, but we've all got it. The problem is, how do we change? How do we go about becoming more like Jesus? And that's what Paul's doing here. Let's look at verse 17, and we'll just break it down a little bit at a time. He says this: "Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds." Paul's saying, if you're going to change, it's going to mean two things. It's going to mean starting to do some things, number one, but it's also going to mean stopping doing some other things. He's saying you must no longer walk in this direction. Don't go this way. And the direction he doesn't want them to walk in, well, it's as the Gentiles do. Meaning, I don't want you to walk the way the rest of society around you walks. I don't want you to be formed by the pattern of what goes on in the world about you. I want you to walk in a different direction. According to the Bible, change happens not just by doing more, by trying really hard at a whole load of new things. Change doesn't just come through frantic activity. It happens by stopping doing some things too. Change comes not just through busyness, because some of us are busy enough. Not through activity, but actually through abstinence, through stopping some things. The good news is this: Paul's not asking you to do more. You can breathe a sigh of relief at this point. He's asking you to do things differently, to live differently, not to add a whole load more regulations into your life, because you don't need that. We're a member of the European Union. We have enough regulations in our lives as it is. He's asking us to stop trying to work really, really hard, but walk in a different direction. We'll see in a minute. And he's saying, here's how it works. The battleground for change is in your minds. He talks to the Gentiles about the futility in their minds. The location for change in your life is not about circumstances. It's not about job opportunities. It's not about training or education. It's about what's between your ears. It's to do with how we think. Some of us want to be able to behave differently without first changing the way that we think. We can only change the way we behave if we're willing to change the way we think. Let me give you an example. Take raising children. for instance. Parents want to act like loving, patient parents, don't you? Nod in my direction if they say, that's the intention. But you won't be able to act like a loving, patient parent unless you're changing your thinking along the way. My brother's got three small children, and he used to live out in Australia not long ago, and he had some friends come and visit them. He's often away, and they were touring around Australia in a very plush, kitted out motorhome, you know, one of these things, all singing, all dancing. And they're hanging out in the house. His friend needs to go out to the motorhome to get something from the back of the van. So he goes out to the house, gets in the back of the van, doesn't realise, but my brother's son follows him in to the motorhome. He's at the back of the motorhome. My brother's son sees the cabin at the front, mission control, and thinks, wouldn't it be nice to sit in there and pretend to drive? Gets in the front seat and somehow manages to release the handbrake. The other piece of information you need to know is that my brother's driveway is on a slope leading down to the house. Very expensive camper van rolls down the hill and meets very expensive house. The result is very expensive. The bad news is my brother doesn't just own the house, he's renting it, so it doesn't even belong to him. They look through his friend's mobile home insurance and discover that he's not covered for a four-year-old driving. It's a bit of a shock. Now, in that situation, what my brother thinks is actually vitally important. Does Stuart think that discipline is about punishment or about training? Which is it? If he thinks like the world does, that motorhomes and houses are really, really important, then he's going to respond out of anger and frustration. If his thinking is godly, he's going to be thinking, what's really important here is how I train this child. And he'll respond with firmness and grace. You see, the way we think is absolutely critical. Proverbs says this, that as a man thinks within himself, so he is. In other words, how you think shapes who you are. And ultimately, nothing is more important than if our minds are open or closed towards God. How we think about God is the most important thing in our lives. And Paul has stark warnings for people who think about God and reject him altogether. He says this in verse 18. He says that those that reject God in their minds are darkened in their understanding, separated from God. He uses the term alienated from the life of God. So cut off from the life of God, and ignorant. Not in the terms of not knowing things, but ignoring God. Romans 1 is a parallel passage to this where Paul says, for although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Not a good place. How does somebody end up that cut off, that separated from God? Well, Paul gives us a warning here. That's why he's writing to Christians, warning them about this. He's saying it's a slippery slope in process here. He's saying it's not an instant thing, it's a gradual thing. He says in verse 18, it starts like this. It starts when we harden our hearts. The word here is the same as a mortar mix setting in the Greek. So it's something that really will set and harden off. When we allow our conscience to become hardened, that's what he's talking about. Our hearts are always either becoming more tender towards God or harder towards God. It's not a static thing. We're going in one direction or the other. Which one is you at the moment? Is your heart increasingly softened towards God and his purposes and what he's got to say? Or is it gradually getting harder and harder? Next, he says that there's an insensitivity towards the Holy Spirit that comes in. Literally, to become calloused. I would have learnt to play the guitar, but I could never get past that point where your fingers really, really hurt. Guitarists, do you know what I mean? I just wasn't brave enough, I guess. Guitarists, they can only play the guitar because over a period of time, they have pushed through the pain barrier and little calluses appear on the tops of their fingers. Guitarists, am I right? Yeah, that's how it works, isn't it? You can't do it without the calluses on your hands, the hardened bits of skin. When we start sinning, our consciences convict us. But if you keep going through the pain barrier of that, you'll reach the point where it doesn't bother you anymore. And you get callous around the edge. It gets worse than that, though. Stage three is when we literally give ourselves over to sin, Paul is saying. Giving up to sensuality. Verse 19. Where we simply just don't care anymore. My mum's best friend had a secret affair. And it ended up train wrecking her marriage. She left her husband and her family. But by the time she confessed to my mum, she was bulletproof. Because she'd hardened herself off. Anything my mum said just bounced off her hard heart. When you stop listening to godly friends, you know you're in trouble. She had given herself over to this thing. And then finally, stage four, when we get greedy to do more. Greedy to practice every kind of impurity, Paul says. The warning here is that sin grows. That's the message of this section. I promise you that at the start, the lie will be, I can control this thing. I can, you know, there's a bit of a problem here, but I can keep a lid on this. I'm in control here. The truth is, you start out holding on to sin, but before you know it, sin has got hold of you. And of course, it impacts not just you, but the people around you that you love. The warning here, the cold hard truth, is that sin isn't stagnant. It will grow in your life like a cancer. How many of you know this is true? This Christmas, you're going to get together with your extended family, your relatives. And my hunch is that in your family, there are some slightly more mature members of your family, either grandparents or parents or perhaps a cranky great aunt. And they're the kind of characters who have little idiosyncrasies, shall we say. And you know the truth is that the older you get, the more exaggerated some aspects of a person's personality can become. Some of you have got images of your family members in your minds right now. The point is this. Someone starts out in their 30s, maybe being a bit cautious with money. By the time they reach their 50s, though, this has become a bit of an issue, and they're not the most generous person that you know. Once they reach their 70s, they're complaining about the cost of everything, they live in a cold house, they make you bring your own coffee, and won't let you have the light on because it uses too much electricity. They have sown into this pattern of thinking, and it's reaped consequences in their lives. Now, we look at them with a bit of, you know, perhaps slight mirth and a bit of disdain. But my question for you is this. If you are like you are now, and you keep on living like you are, what will you be like in 20 or 30 years' time? Unless something miraculous happens, you will be like you are now, only more so. I notice some wives are sort of shuffling away from their husbands at this point. Let me say, guys, if you are in your 30s now and you have a tendency to be a little bit grumpy and impatient, can you do me a favour and leave the church before you hit 60? Because I just don't want to be around for that. Why is it like that? It's because sin grows in our lives. James 1, it uses graphic images, says, after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. It's like something erupts in the inside. The film Alien did nothing for that. You know, it just sort of illustrated that's what sin does in our lives. If you sow into cynicism, you'll reap depression and suicidal thoughts. If you keep getting angry, you'll get stress-related diseases or an ulcer. If you live for sexual gratification, you'll get a sex addiction. If you repeatedly sow into worrying about your kids, which is a sin, by the way, they'll either pick up a root of fear from you or they'll rebel because they feel so stifled. We reap what we sow. You cannot manage your sin. It's not static. It will grow. It will spread and ultimately take you over. Unless something happens. Help. How do we handle this? That's where Paul carries on in the rest of this passage. Let's pick it up again in verse 20. We desperately need some answers. It says this. But that is not the way you learn Christ. assuming that you have heard about him and were taught in him as the truth is in Jesus, to put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and to put on the new self, created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. Paul starts out saying, don't walk in this direction, hardening your heart, becoming insensitive to God. His answer is, go in the opposite direction. A bit like you can't drive a car east and west at the same time. It's one or the other. So what's the opposite direction to hardening your heart? The other direction is Jesus. This is really important. The answer to hardening your heart and getting separated from God is not becoming a really good person or trying really hard. That's the trap of moralism and legalism. Moralism is this belief that the goal of our lives is to become better people. And legalism is the set of rules we establish in order to become those better people. Except that it's just a route to slavery, to living on a treadmill of expectation that we place upon ourselves. The harsh truth is this, that hell will be full of people who spend their lives trying to be a good person. But of course, we can never be good enough for God. Knowing Jesus is what sets us free. The goal of life is not self-improvement or even becoming a nicer person. It's knowing Jesus, and all the answers are in relationship with him. The secret, Paul says, is to put off your old self and put on your new self. It's the image of clothing. One that Paul refers to often, Colossians 3, is another example. He says, take off your old practices and put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge of its creator. It's the image of getting dressed. And it's one that God has given us as just a very practical illustration of how we're to live out this Christian life. It's a spiritual reality, a spiritual truth that is linked to an everyday practice. We get dressed every morning. At least I hope you do. It's a practical illustration for us. Paul says that we put off our old clothes. Before we knew Christ, we were wearing spiritual clothes because we're all spiritual beings. We're not just flesh and blood. Except that those spiritual clothes were affected by the things that we had done and the things that others had done to us. Let me show you what I mean. Imagine these are the clothes I was wearing before I became a Christian. Now, you need to know a little bit about me. Before I became a Christian, I was really cynical. I was only a young man, but I'd experienced a fair amount of rejection through my family circumstances, and that made me suspicious, and it made me bitter. And inside, there was something acid and sort of rancid about me. It stunk. A bit like this old yogurt. And that cynicism and bitterness was plastered all over my old self. But not only that, before I became a Christian, because of the rejection, I responded in rebellion. Not in an outward way, because I'm not like that, but in a sneaky, devious kind of way. And that trait was like a long red line running through my life. This isn't going to come out, is it, babe? I was plastered with it. But worse than that, I had hatred in my heart. This is what I was genuinely like. I had murderous thoughts. And Jesus said that if we even think of killing someone, it's like we have. We're stained in the same way. And to be honest, the person I thought about killing most was me. It's hard to communicate the severity of this. The Bible uses the strongest possible language when it describes sin. In places it refers to it as excrement. I thought, how do I illustrate that?
No.
I've got here one of Zachary's nappies. Do you want to see? Close your eyes if you don't want to see. Now, decency forbids me. This is actually chocolate spread, but I had you going for a minute to prove it to you. It's chocolate spread. Just nobody switch it for tonight, otherwise I'm stuffed. But this is what the Bible says. And it says that our deeds were like filthy rags all over us in the strongest possible terms. Isaiah puts it like this. You're not going to be able to take me seriously now, stood at the front like this. Isaiah puts it like this. He says, "We have all become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous deeds are like a polluted garment. We all fade like a leaf. Our iniquities, like the wind, take us away." So that's how I stood before God. Filthy, corrupted, defiled. That's some of my sins. What was on your garments? What was on your spiritual clothes? That's how I was. Until I gave my life to God. Mark, do you want to come up here? Mark, for the purposes of this illustration, is going to be Jesus. And this is what happened. When I became a Christian, Isaiah 53 says that the punishment that has brought me peace is now on him. And my filthy, disgusting clothes got hung with Jesus on a cross. I no longer have them. And instead, Isaiah says, I get a garment of salvation. I get something that is pure and white and clean. My old self is on him. And I'm now found in Jesus. Clean as the driven snow. I've got these garments of salvation. The point here that Paul is making is that this exchange has happened. It is done. It's not now that you're trying to be a really good person. It's done. That means that we leave behind all of our destructive anger, all of our fearful thinking, all of our sexual immorality, all of our selfish behavior, and all of it is gone. We don't live that way now because we want to be good. We live that way now because we are good. It is finished. It is dealt with once and for all. John Stott says this: "It is because we have already put off our old nature in that decisive act of repentance called conversion, that we can be logically commanded to put away all the practices which belong to that old and rejected life." Thank you, Mark. We change, therefore, not through human efforts, not through trying really, really hard, but rather through acknowledging who we are now. We're sons and daughters of the King. And every single day, in all kinds of different situations, you choose what clothes you want to wear. And you can wear the old stinking stuff, or you can wear the new stuff. It's up to you. But after all, who wants to live in fear anymore when perfect love will cast out fear? Who wants to be greedy for money when we're inheriting a kingdom? Why try and project a fake image to people when you're a child of the King? Paul's saying you're someone different now. And because of that, some behavior is appropriate for you and some no longer is. Let's put it this way. Spiritually, you have changed address. You're not who you once were. Why would you want to go back to where you were once living? Most graphic example I've ever seen of changing address is when a group of us, when I first came to Bedford, used to share a house known as River Street. For the uninitiated, River Street was basically a three-story skip with windows. Although it did have commanding views of the multi-story car park. Words almost run out to describe it. It was dirty, it was grimy, and it smelt bad. the guy who bought the shopping, a chap called Martin White, God bless him, fed us on a diet of crispy pancakes and mechanically reclaimed chicken burgers. I didn't see a vitamin in 3 years. Scurvy was a very real risk. Okay, the only ones thriving in that household were the family of slugs that lived in the shower room. That's how life was. David Attenborough could have discovered new species in the shag pile carpets. It was rough. Someone once walked past the front door, actually, and said to me, are you squatting here? And I said, no, we're dumb enough to pay rent for this place. And I shared this house with a bunch of guys, and amongst them was Pete Newsom, who's not here today. And one day, Pete Newsom met Meryl and fell in love, and they got married, and Pete moved out. He was now living in a nice flat in a different part of town. Do you think he ever wanted to go back to River Street? He laughed at us. Why on earth would he want to leave domestic bliss with Meryl and move back in with us in River Street? It'd make no sense. In the same way, Paul's saying, it makes no sense for you to go back to sin when you've got what you've got. The point Paul is making is this: you don't have to live this way anymore. What is it for you this morning that you want to leave behind? What is it that got crucified with Jesus on the cross, but you're still carrying around in your life? Biblical change comes about through acknowledging who we really are, not by trying really hard. And the process of sanctification, the process of becoming more like Jesus, is all about learning to live out the new identity that we have already got. One of the, I guess, the saddest and most wonderful things I ever saw was when I was spending 2 months working in an orphanage in Brazil. We were helping build one orphanage and working with orphans in another. And teams would go out from the orphanage into downtown Sao Paulo. And they would go into what the Brazilians call the favelas, the slums, the shanty towns. And these are dark, dark places. And they would go in and rescue children that were just being neglected or abused. One day they came across a lad called Edgar. And when they found him, he was living in a cage. This boy must have been, I don't know, six. But because of the malnourishment, he was only the size of maybe a 3 or 4 year old. And he had outgrown the cage that they kept him in. And because of that, he had this hunched, stooped appearance. It took time, once he was rescued, for him to learn to stand again. It was like he was now out of his prison, but it was taking time for him to stand in this new reality. In the same way, and just as graphically, you and I have been rescued from our slum prison, and it takes time for us to realize who we are now and the liberty that we enjoy. You are different. It is just that it's taking time for your mind to catch up with what happened when you became a Christian. And sanctification is all about getting your mind to catch up with this new reality as fast as you can. Because the more you can do that, the more you can stand tall. And the more you can be a testimony to the liberty that you now enjoy compared to the prisoner that you once were. Paul is saying, I want you to live out this freedom for all it's worth. If you're a Christian here today, then you were once like that, trapped, dirty, and without hope. But now the kindness and love of God has rescued us. And we can live differently. I just wanted to finish with one personal illustration of how I'm trying to live this out. Because the application could be as varied as there are people in the room. But Simon's away speaking in London, so I can get away with this. He's turning down more invites than he's accepting to speak at other churches. And I've watched in recent years how God is using him and raising him up. And I'm in my prayer life at times have been praying, God, I feel like maybe I should pull back a little bit in order to give Simon the space that he needs to exercise his gifting. But in recent years, as I've prayed about that over the last 1 or 2 years, I felt a rebuke from the Lord. I felt him say that if we're to do all that God is calling us to do as a church, that it's going to need every single one of us to be all that we can be in God. My godly prayer of, Lord, give Simon space, was just fear and false humility. And the truth is, my fear and false humility died on the cross with Jesus, just like that shirt hang on Mark's back. I want to wear different clothes now, so my prayer life is changing and my attitude is changing along with it. That's one way I am trying to live out these new clothes that I've now got. Because the truth is, there are around 3,000 Christians in this town, and that means that there are about 97,000 people who don't know the love of God. How dare I leave the work of extending God's kingdom to someone else? I've got a role to play, as have you. God's got people for me to reach that Simon couldn't reach. And of course, he's got people for you to reach that I couldn't reach. We need to start training our minds to catch up with what God has done for us. And I'm just trusting that God will give you different places where you know you need to leave the old clothes behind and start wearing the new clothes.